calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Paula Abdul for the Supreme Court. This is great. This is from BorowitzReport.com. Supreme Court watchers were stunned today. You'll recall, by the way, George Bush went off to Scotland, the G8 meeting. We'll have a little more information on that. Some interesting things happening there. He went off with a list of potential nominees, said he hadn't really thought about it, hadn't studied it, hadn't discussed it with anybody. Apparently, he's been oblivious for the last 4.5 years that there may be a Supreme Court nominee coming along, that, you know, somebody coming for the court, he may have to replace somebody. Apparently, he didn't notice when Justice Rehnquist hobbled up to give him the oath of office. So anyhow, he said he hadn't thought about it much. He hadn't given it much thought. It's sort of, you know, the same way he was not thinking much about Osama bin Laden, you'll recall. You know, among other things and people. Osama who? Osama bin who? You know, this is... time will tell, of course, whether we ever find Osama bin Laden, but George Bush.
So I don't know where he is. I just don't spend that much time on him, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, it doesn't spend much time on him. And in fact, by the way, George Bush's birthday is today. Just happy birthday, George. It's also the Dalai Lama's birthday. The Dalai Lama pushing 70, George Bush pushing 60. He's 59 today. And George Bush, just in memory of your birthday, a Bush moment.
Osama bin Laden doesn't get to decide. The American people decide. I decided the right action was in Iraq.
Yeah. So anyhow, he goes off to the G8 conference and takes with him a folder full of potential nominees for the Supreme Court. And now come the results. At a White House press briefing, spokesman Scott McClellan confirmed that Paula Abdul has in fact emerged as a favorite to fill Justice O'Connor's slot. He said, "I think Paula Abdul's abilities as a judge, which millions of Americans have had an opportunity to witness week in, week out, speaks for itself." Even as Mr. McClellan touted Ms. Abdul's fitness to serve in the High Court of the Land, legal experts debated the qualifications of the idle judge, IDOL, who has no legal degree and has not had a hit song since My Love is for Real, which reached number 28 in 1995. Davis Crennell, a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, believes that Ms. Abdul may be the perfect replacement for Justice O'Connor. "First and foremost, she's a woman, and second, she occupies the middle," he said. "In her case, the middle between Simon Cowell and Randy Jackson." Professor Crennell warns, however, that Ms. Abdul may have to clean up her act if she's to don the robe of Supreme Court justice. "Yeah, it wouldn't look right," she says, "if during their deliberations she started kissing on Justice Scalia." At the White House, spokesman McClellan said, "The American people would be asked to make the ultimate decision about Ms. Abdul," and then offered a toll-free telephone number. Elsewhere, Andy Borowitz reports, BorowitzReports.com, former Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork told reporters today he was tanned, rested, and ready. Yeah. So anyhow, Bush goes over to the G8 summit. This, of course, is the big economic meeting for the year. The G8 nations, the world's, in theory, the world's eight most powerful, economically most powerful nations. The collection, I guess you could call the world's superpower, the wealthiest nations, the industrialized nations. They're meeting in Glen Eagles, Scotland. And interesting, the New York Times observed or made the observation that there are two world powers now. A second world power has emerged, one being the United States, the other being world public opinion. And increasingly, this is the case. It's George Bush in the U.S. versus world public opinion. And so, you know, do we want to sign a declaration to make poverty history now? Do we want to clean up the air? Do we want to roll back the greenhouse gas emissions? For a rare moment, the Center for American Progress notes, Brookings scholar Susan Rice writes, global poverty reduction is near the top of the international agenda. It's hip, it's moral, and smart policy. So that's global poverty, particularly in Africa. Dealing with the situation in Africa. And then there's also global warming, dealing with the situation with regard to global warming. This is something that Tony Blair has tried to move to the very front of the agenda. He wants this to be a major big deal. And the reason, you know, a variety of reasons, but certainly one of the main reasons is that if global warming, according to the scientists, if global warming reaches a certain threshold where enough fresh water starts coming into the North Atlantic, either from melting glaciers on Greenland or from the Arctic ice being broken up to the point that all this fresh water from the Arctic ice is flowing down, it could shut down what's called the Great Conveyor Belt. The Great Conveyor Belt is this flow of warm water that comes from the Pacific, which is actually a couple of inches deeper or taller, higher than the Atlantic. The Atlantic is landlocked, as it were, on the two sides. It's not entirely landlocked all the way around, but on two sides, and then you got the Arctic ice up at the top. And so this flow of warm water comes into the Atlantic. So it goes south around the southern tip of Africa, and flows up along the, you know, up across the Atlantic. The Coriolis, you know, spinning in the earth, kind of moves it across, and it comes up around the Gulf of Mexico, and in fact we call it the Gulf Stream. And then it picks up a lot of heat there at the equator. I mean, it comes in warmer to begin with, and it's less salty than the water in the Atlantic. The water in the Atlantic is more salty than the water in the Pacific, slightly more salty, because there's not so much circulation with the Pacific. And so this water, this fresher water, comes all the way up to about 200-300 miles south of Greenland. And there, by the time it reaches that point, it has released so much heat into the atmosphere. And in the process of releasing this heat, so much of its own water into the atmosphere. It's like a river within the ocean. In fact, it's larger, it's 100 times larger than all the rivers on Earth combined. Flowing continuously. And when it gets to this point, a couple hundred miles south of the southern tip of Greenland, by that time it has lost so much heat and so much water that it has become more saline, more salt in it than the Atlantic Ocean, and cold. And so at that point it settles to the bottom of the ocean. And there's this whirlpool, this column of falling water. There are several of them, actually, several small ones, and there's one major one. And sometimes of the year you can actually see it from outer space or from a high plane. You can see it. It actually kind of breaks the surface. A ship goes through it, it'll tilt slightly. In fact, there's a lot of speculation that these whirlpools, this end of the Great Conveyor Belt, is the place that was on the maps of the ancient mariners. And it settles down to the floor of the ocean, and then it starts a long trip along the floor of the Atlantic Ocean back down between the north and south, between North and South America on the left side, and Europe and Africa on the right side, back down around the southern tip of Africa and back out into the Pacific, at the floor of the sea level rather than at the surface level. And 1,000 years later, that water makes it all the way back into the place in the Pacific where it started and begins the process all over again. This is called the Great Conveyor Belt, and what it does is it brings enough heat from the Pacific and from the equator up into the northern part of the Atlantic Ocean. And that heat then goes into the air just west of Europe. It brings enough heat that England, the United Kingdom, which is at the same latitude, essentially, as much of Alaska, that England has the climate that it does. They have a temperate climate. And that, you know, coastal, you know, France and Spain and the coastal European countries have, you know, nice warm climates. Even the Scandinavian countries are not entirely landlocked. And all the evidence is that every time this Great Conveyor Belt has shut down in the past, and it seems to do so every 15,000 years or so, it does it cyclically. It's a very, very delicate, you know, delicately balanced mechanism that every time it's shut down in the past, that Europe, within 2 or 3 years, very rapidly in the geologic time span, within 2 or 3 years, Europe is covered with ice. It's covered with glaciers. And, of course, rendering it uninhabitable, and you can't grow crops there. In fact, there's a good body of evidence that suggests that the only folks who were actually winter adapted were the Neanderthals. And that's why the Neanderthals were able to survive in Europe through the glaciation period. And when the glaciation period ended the last time, that the modern humans came up and killed them all off. But I digress. So the Gulf Stream, as it were, is the only thing that's keeping Europe habitable. And the science indicates that if global warming reaches the point where the glaciers on Greenland, which are melting rapidly, continue to, you know, start just pick up a little more steam in terms of their melting, or if the Arctic ice cap breaks up to the point that fresh water is coming down, or that the Pacific water can come over the top of the Earth instead of looping around the bottom, coming over the top, it won't be bringing all that heat with it. It will plunge Europe back into a glacier period. And I'm telling you, everybody in Europe knows this science. This is no secret. What I've just described to you is something that school kids in the UK can tell you about. They talk about it on TV in Germany, in France, in Scandinavian countries. Everybody knows this. Very few people in America know this. I mean, there's a chapter about it in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. There's, you know, I've written about it on commondreams.org. Other people have written about it. It's not a secret. There's no shortage of scientific papers that have been written on it. But here in the United States, it's like the media is afraid to talk about it for fear that anytime they bring this up, that the oil industry funded groups, you know, like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, they're going to get out there and say, yeah, you got to have us on if you're going to be fair and balanced. I tell our side of it. We don't think that that's true. Period. But what about all these scientists? Well, you can't always trust scientists. Wait, here, talk to our scientists. You don't seem to have very many scientists. Well, but we have some very highly paid ones. Not that just the Competitive Enterprise Institute would be saying that sort of thing. It's a whole bunch of groups. So anyhow, George Bush being leaned on by Tony Blair to stop just parroting the company line of the oil companies looks like Bush might be willing to engage in a compromise. Certainly he's still not going to sign Kyoto. Although it's really weird because he said, when he was interviewed by the British yesterday, he said if he'd signed Kyoto, it would have cost us $200 to $400 million, and it would have lost us 3 million jobs. Excuse me, we have lost 3 million jobs since George Bush came into office, 3 million manufacturing jobs, and we've spent $300 billion on the war in Iraq. So having signed the Kyoto Protocol would have cost us the same, according to Bush, I mean, this is the worst case scenario, over what, 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, I don't think that we could do much worse than what we have right now. And frankly, if we had signed Kyoto, it would have not only created jobs, it would have birthed an entire industry, an alternative energy industry. And, you know, really good things would have come out of it. Very good things could come out of it. Well, maybe Bush is willing to reach a compromise. That'll be interesting to see. It's, you know, I'm not here to bash Bush every day. If he does something right, I want to salute him for it. Let's hope he does. Let's hope he rises to the occasion. Time will tell. It's 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And who's gonna pay the bill?
Well, you and me, of course.
Who's gonna pay the bill?
Maybe our grandchildren.
Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol Hill, not the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com. Our website, if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, click live chat. You want to go to the message board, you click message board. It'll get you there. If you'd like to see the articles on democracy and other topics that I've written about, click articles on democracy and lots more there on the website. The world's other superpower awakens. One of the folks in our chat room, I asked the question, and this is actually a good question, because it's the frame that the Republicans have put forward. And I think it's really important that we understand the frame that the Republicans have put forward. And the question was something to the effect of, how will we benefit from an economic slowdown if Bush signs Kyoto? And unfortunately, conventional wisdom, or I don't even want to say conventional wisdom, the media in the United States has bought this idea that if Bush had signed Kyoto, that that would slow down economic activity in the United States. And it's nonsense. All Kyoto does is slow down the emissions, slow down global emissions. It reduces levels of carbon dioxide gas and other gases. Now, in order to reduce those, what do you have to do? You have to develop new technologies. Now, developing new technologies does what? It's a growth industry. It's like saying, we got to come up with a new way of doing things, but it's not going to create any new jobs. What? It's come on. The reality, the truth, there is a germ of truth in this. There will be an economic slowdown for the oil industry, for the coal industry, for the nuclear industry. There will be an economic slowdown for Bush's buddies. There'll be an economic slowdown for the folks who put Ronald Reagan into power. There'll be an economic slowdown for the billionaires and trillionaires who have been running this government basically since 1980. Or certainly influencing it very, very heavily. Ever since Reagan came in and took Jimmy Carter's solar collectors off the roof of the White House as one of his first official acts of office. There will be an economic slowdown for them. But for the rest of us, for the rest of the United States, as we save the world, we will be developing new companies to make solar panels and windmills and biomass and thermal energy and geothermal. And it's just no end to the innovation that could come about if we simply were to say, okay, that's it. We're not going to be hooked on fossil fuels anymore. They ain't no more worth making them. You know, there is no more fossil. There's roughly the rough estimate is that there were about 2 trillion barrels of oil in the ground worldwide. We've consumed, as of around 1980, we had consumed about 1 trillion of them. And that second trillion is going to be progressively a lot harder to get. We're going to see $100 barrel oil within a year, in my mind. It just seems the logical thing. And you're going to see $3, $4, $5 a gallon gasoline in the United States, I think, before the end of this Bush term. Why not just go there to begin with and say, hey, fossil fuel, they're not making it anymore. They're not making uranium anymore. There are roughly 20 countries in the world that basically control the world's supply of uranium. Not all of them are friends of ours. We're not, we don't control enough uranium to fuel our own nuclear power plants. And if you look at the entire world supply, known reserves of uranium, it's only enough to fuel the nuclear power plants of the planet for another 25 to 40 years. I mean, that's the timeline, and how much oil is left as well. Isn't it time to develop alternatives? Let's do it in a way that can produce an economic boom for the world. It would be a boom that would make the computer boom of the 1990s look puny. And it would last for a long, long period of time. As communities become more energy independent, they become more competent at developing their own local industries. You know, wonderful stuff could happen out of this. Really good things could come out of this. But, Bush doesn't get it. Well, let's hope that Tony Blair can have some positive influence on him. 29 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, tomhartman.com. And Jim in Michigan on the line. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you. That was a great discussion about global warming. I just want to make one comment, if I could.
Please.
I'm up here in Michigan, and we get cold days, as you know.
Yes, I
do. And I always hear jokes on, oh, global warming, ha, ha, ha. And that's a fundamental misunderstanding, and I try to tell that to people. global warming doesn't mean everything is going to get warmer everywhere.
No, in fact, what it means is actually that the extremes will increase. This is also an issue for the folks in Africa, because what has happened during the previous glaciation periods, or even the previous warm periods, is that the deserts increase in Africa, you know, so you'll have more starvation and famine. And in the northern hemisphere, the extreme northern hemisphere, it gets actually colder.
Right. Global warming is the engine that will drive climate change.
Right.
Some places will get colder, some places will get warmer, some places will get wetter, some places will get drier.
And every place, the extremes will get more extreme and the storms will be more severe because the atmosphere has more moisture and more heat in it. And heat is energy. And energy, you know, that heat energy is what drives thunderstorms and hurricanes and tornadoes. And that's why, you know, you're seeing that the hurricanes and typhoons of the last few decades have been the worst in history. And you know, and the last, I don't have the statistic right in front of me. I was going to say, I think that it's 8 of the last 10 years have seen the worst. Well, I shouldn't quote a statistic. I don't have it right in front of me, so I won't. But it's out there. It's out there. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thanks, Tom.
I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Steve, also in Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi. I'm calling because of the things about the Patriot Act and the recent erosions of the Fourth Amendment.
Yes, sir.
And my dad made a comment to me recently that I was wondering if you could tell me in what way this argument is flawed. He said, why should we worry? We have nothing to hide.
Yeah, that's the argument that tyrants have always made. You know, if you have nothing to hide. Now, you have nothing to hide at the moment. What happens if the government decides to make criminal dissent and you don't agree with that?
Well, my dad is trying to argue, like, we have nothing to hide. We don't do any crimes, and so why would we have to worry about being searched?
Well, but the reality is that if you show up at a George Bush rally, paid for by We the People, you know, one of his Social Security events or something like that.
Yeah.
And you show up and you want to hold a sign that says no blood for oil, or, you know, vote for John Kerry, or anything that is viewed as not agreeing with George Bush, they will stick a gun in your face and frog march you off to a free speech zone.
Translation, a cage, right?
Yeah, right. In many cases. I mean, you know, sometimes more than others. It depends on the place. And if you disagree with that, you now have something to hide. You are now an enemy of the state. Is that, you know, see, it's a slippery slope. You either have freedom or you don't.
That's what I was thinking. That's what I've been trying to tell my dad.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's difficult, though, when my dad's 7 decades old, but...
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, he's probably comfortable, and there's some folks whose minds are not going to change, and so you just say, you know, hey, you're my dad, and I love you, and God bless you, and, you know, let's move on. Let's
and talk good about luck. You might need it.
Yeah, there you go. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Ed in San Juan Capistrano on the line. Hey, Ed, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good advice. Good advice. There was an old saying that if you want all your dreams to come true, wake up.
Yeah.
And you were just talking about global warming. I think what we need to do is wake up.
Yeah.
And I don't want to labor it too much, but, you know, we got commercials out here in California that says, would you rather have clean air or your car? And, of course, the woman gets on, well, I'd rather give up my clean air than lose my car.
Right.
And
yeah.
That's not the question, Tom.
Yeah, yeah. It's called a false choice.
And you just want to slap them. We're not saying give up your car.
Right.
You know.
We're very thoughtful people. I mean, you know, in this regard, Julian Simon was right. Julian Simon was the darling of the right. He's deceased now, but he and Paul Ehrlich and a number of others have had, you know, long running battles. And Julian Simon, in fact, Daniel Quinn, the guy who wrote the Ishmael stories, it used to be the homepage, the danielquinn.org, I think it is, used to have, you know, do you want to save the world, yes or no? And if you click yes, you get into Dan Quinn's website. If you click no, it would take you to Julian Simon's website. This is when Julian Simon was still alive. And Julian Simon used to say that really there's nothing to worry about. You don't have to worry about all this stuff. You don't have to worry about global warming. You don't have to worry about economics. You don't have to worry about population. Because one of the things that's not in any of anybody's equations is human engineering. ingenuity. And human ingenuity has always pulled the fat out of the fire in the past, and it always will in the future. Well, first of all, that's not altogether true. Epidemics have pulled and plagues have pulled the fat out of the fire. You know, the Renaissance came about in large part because of the depopulation of Europe, so the resource versus people ratio changed, and it put a kink in feudalism. And, you know, there's things like that, and the whole American experiment of living out the Enlightenment. Enlightenment ideals came about largely because the Europeans were able to conquer essentially North America, killing off a lot of the Indians with disease and killing off the rest of them with guns and disease-laden blankets and so forth. And cheap land drove that. So there's a lot of variables in the pot. So Julian Simon wasn't altogether right, but there is a germ of truth to what he said. And that is that we are the animal that can create something out of nothing and does so regularly. Just look around. Look around right now. Probably 90% of what you're looking at started out as an idea in somebody's head. You know, unless you're sitting in the forest. Literally, I mean, where I am here in this radio studio, 100% of what I'm looking at right now started out as an idea in somebody's head. And out of that thought came something. And it came all these things. And that's the thing. It's to say that transportation can only be a gasoline-powered automobile is nuts.
Absolutely.
It's pathetic.
Hey, Tom, one other point. And I know you're not talking about this. Colleen Rowley.
Yes, sir.
Announced her she's running for Congress today. The FBI whistleblower.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I heard she was going to.
I'm kind of hesitant to ever back somebody because, you know, it's like, well, someplace along the line they're screwy. But she gave an interview today on the Today Show, and she sounded really, you know, solid-based.
Yeah. Well, we'll check her out and see if we can get her on the program.
Yeah, kind of.
Sounds like a plan.
Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ed. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Colleen Rowley is a good woman. She's a good person. She knows what's going on. That goes a long way in my book. It goes a long, long way. Some of the things the American Taliban has in common with the Al-Qaeda Taliban, and it's funny how the right-wingers try to claim American liberals are in league with crazy fundamentalist Muslims, right? This is from the Daily Cause, by the way. This is a great little posting there. How the right-wingers in America, those liberals, they just they're on Osama's side. No, sorry. The reality is, as this posting by Cause points out on the Daily Cause, that we are not at all about what radical, fundamentalist, right-wing Islam stands for. Now, the folks running the Republican Party may be in favor of the same things that radical Islam stands for. But those are not the ideals of liberal democracy. The history of the United States. For example, religion and government. Liberals from George Washington to today. George Washington, who called himself a liberal, said, "I hope that America shall ever be at the forefront of liberalism, that we shall always become a more liberal nation." George Washington believed in the separation of church and state. Absolutely. In fact, he refused to declare himself a Christian. Jefferson wrote about it in his diaries, how they tried to trap him into it, and he still wouldn't do it. So from George Washington until the end of Bill Clinton's presidency, until 2000, by and large, we had a government that believed that church is great. You want to go to church? It's a marvelous thing. Religion is an important, you know, there's been no rhetoric about the opiate of the masses sort of thing. It's, you know, but it's separate from government. Government doesn't run religion. Government doesn't pick religion. Religion doesn't pick government. And this was a radical departure, by the way. It's at the core of modern American liberalism. It was a radical departure from the way that past governments are done. Historically, prior to the American experiment, as far as I know, every government in history, arguably with the single exception of the Athenian Greeks, but I suspect that even there was a state religion, the state chose the religion, or the religion chose the state. In the case of, you know, where the Vatican moved in and took over land, and the Roman Empire properties were quite substantial. You know, certainly in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, well, up through the 14th, 15th centuries, Well, even all the way up to the early 19th century, or late 18th century. So, historically, you had governments picking religions. I mean, Mary the First, she was referred to as Bloody Mary, because where the drink name came from, actually, because she declared that England had to be Catholic. And people who didn't want to become Catholic, they were put to death. And then Elizabeth I came along and said, no, no, you've got to be Protestant. And, you know, the British had a civil war over this. And they still have an official state religion, the Church of England. Okay. Historically, you know, countries had official state religions. And the French Revolution, I mean, they declared there was no religion, and that became a religion. Robespierre, Maximilian Robespierre, when he really cranked up the terrors and got them going, he renamed the months and re-changed the calendar and said this is the year zero and tried to invent essentially a whole new religion of no religion, of worshiping nature. It was very strange. So the liberal American experiment, the experiment of liberal American democracy, was the experiment of separating church from state and having state be secular. That is to say, secular meaning operating for the public good, on behalf of the public, for the public. And the church could run for the benefit of the church or for the benefit of the people, however you want to argue it. Well, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, they believe the church and state should be the same thing. The American Taliban, Dobson, Jerry Falwell, Pat Rarr, they believe the church and state should be the same thing. Liberals, from George Washington to today, believe that the church and state should be separate. Schools. In the area of schools, this list from Kaz and Daily Kaz. In the schools, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, they believe that schools should be run by the religious and should include religious indoctrination, and the clergy should be supervising this. Well, oddly, the right wingers in America believe the same thing. You'll recall, by the way, one of the first things Hitler did when he took over Germany was create an office of Reichsbishop and appointed Pastor Müller as the Reichsbishop. Pastor Müller committed suicide at the end of the war, looking back on the horrors he had supervised as the leader of the official church of the state of Nazi Germany. But the American Taliban, the Bill Frists, the George W. Bushes, the Pat Robertsons, the Dobsons, the whole bunch of them, the Tony Perkins, they think that children should be praying in school in a particular way to a particular monotheistic god, and that there should be religious instruction, and that, in fact, the state, through a system of school vouchers, should be funding religious education. Liberals from George Washington to today certainly will encourage religion. We'll even encourage religious education. We'll do it by offering them tax cuts. If they're going to run a church, or if they're going to run a school, and a church school, they don't have to pay any taxes. We'll pay for their part of the commons. We'll pay for their fire protection. We'll pay for their police protection. We'll pay for their use of our court infrastructure. We'll pay for their use of our clean air. We'll pay for the roads that go to their place of worship. We'll pay for the rights of way that allow them to have telephone lines, internet connections. We'll pay for all that. We'll pay for their postal service. We'll cover all those things. They won't have to pay a penny. We will subsidize them. But that's it. In our public schools that we're also paying for, we're just, you know, we're not going to go there. We're not going to allow that. So that's just a beginning. You know, with women, with religious freedom, with gays, with torture, with medicine and science, in every area you find the right-wingers in America in agreement with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and liberals saying, no, don't think so. Scott in Arkansas in a truck. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to talk to you about the alternative issue in transportation.
Yes, sir.
Things you're talking about. I agree with you. Anybody who's realistic can see that things are going to have to change. I mean, there's no other, it's just not going to go on the way it has.
Yes, sir.
But I see the problem as being our government is so entrenched with special interest groups that there's no politician who can make these changes the way our government's set up. Because you would immediately be at war with automakers, unions, oil companies. They can't do it.
Well, I don't agree with that, because Jimmy Carter started the process. And I mean, it's just absolutely remarkable. When we first moved to Vermont 10, 12 years ago, and we looked all over the state, you know, looking for houses and for a house. And there were all these solar houses that had been built in Vermont. They had all been built in this little 4-year window of time when Jimmy Carter was president, because there were tax credits offered for people doing that. And there's still solar powered houses, you know. And then all of a sudden that stopped. A lot of super insulated houses in the Northeast as a result of that, all over the United States, but, you know, that we saw there. So, no, I think that it is possible. Jimmy Carter proved it's possible. It's just that since Reagan, there hasn't been a politician who's had the courage to do it.
Well, that's a perfect example. You make my point by talking about Jimmy Carter. I have to think Jimmy Carter was an excellent president because he had the guts to stand up and say, we have to make tough changes.
Yeah, I absolutely
wanted that.
Yeah.
And so he was voted out of office after one term, and he's still maligned to this day.
Yeah, but he wasn't voted out of office because of that, Scott. I mean, it's a whole other argument. But you're absolutely right, and thank you for the call. I appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It doesn't matter what they do. All that matters is my relationship to you.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Don in Los Angeles on the line. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom. One of the things that I've seen on C-SPAN when they were debating the energy bill was one of the Republicans was arguing against an amendment of fuel efficiency for the vehicles and trying to raise it.
Right.
His argument was that if they did that, that it would threaten the financial security of the United States, thus the security of overall of the United States.
Yeah, which is a lie. I mean, the simple reality is that if our cars became more fuel efficient, and they have been, by the way, our cars are less fuel efficient now than they were 25 years ago.
Right.
If we were to go back to manufacturing fuel efficient cars, we would use less oil. That would make us less dependent upon countries like Saudi Arabia. I mean, we're giving them money right now that they're giving to Wahhabists like Osama bin Laden.
They have to also remember the CIA report that said that the biggest threat to the United States is not terrorism, and it's global warming and...
Global warming and oil dependency. Yeah. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Don, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. Mary in Michigan on the line. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First of all, I hate so bad I missed you. You were here 2 weeks ago at Celebration Cinema.
I was.
Yeah.
Had a great time.
I'm so sorry I missed you. But I just have two very quick questions.
Sure.
First of all, regarding Pat Robertson, Dobson, and Tony Perkins and that whole crowd,
mm-hmm.
do you think they'll have as much influence on the 06 elections as they did on the 04 elections? And then also, why don't they ever say anything? They promote Bush as this wonderful Christian man, but yet they never say one word when you got this Mary Carey porno star dining in the White House, the Jeff Gannon story. They never say one word.
That's because it's all about power. It's all about political power. They just, you know, they're addicted to political power, and that's what they want. They want to be, you know, involved with these folks. And do I think they'll have more power in the next election? No, I don't, frankly. I think that their power is on the wane.
Mary, I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too. Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Dave in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dave, we just have a few seconds left. What's up?
I just think that, very briefly, the Republicans have meshed the idea of morality and ethics together, and there's a huge separation between the two of them. One of them, of course, is some Christian moral dogma. The other one is just doing the right thing. And we haven't really separated the two in terms of understanding with people, and we need to do that.
Yeah, good point, Dave, and well said. In fact, before the Ten Commandments, people understood you don't kill others, you don't steal. I mean, you've got tribes all over the world that have never heard of organized religion who have moral codes. Morality is something that transcends religion, absolutely transcends religion. And something, you know, that's a lesson that Jerry Falwell doesn't understand clearly. He hasn't bothered to study history or look ethnography or anthropology or anything, any of that. Yeah, it's just, anyhow. It's Tom Hartman with you. the place where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. What is the ethical dilemma? Or what are the consequences, I guess would be a better way of saying it, of the ethical dilemma of 7% of the United States Army being non-citizens? What does this mean to us? What does this mean to we, the people of the United States of America? What does it mean to the citizens among us? What does it mean to the immigrants among us? What does it mean for our perception around the world? People look at us and at our army. I mean, the French have their Foreign Legion. They'll go into foreign countries and enlist locals. But it's the French Foreign Legion is specifically foreigners. And the British even still have Gurkhas. They still... But... It's not part of their normal army. 7% of our armed services right now are people who are not citizens. And in most cases, their citizenship, their participation in the military, they're immigrants with green cards, their participation in the military is one of their ways to increase the probability of getting into the military. And then on top of that, if you look at Iraq, if you look at the situation in Iraq, one out of every five Americans in Iraq right now is a mercenary, is there for the pay, not because they're a member of our military. They're being paid anywhere from $100,000 to $250,000 a year, in many cases without having to pay any federal income taxes or very little. They get all kinds of tax breaks for this. So our army, 7% non-American, and all the people we have on the ground doing everything from feeding the troops to providing security to fighting wars to rebuilding and things to the extent that we have been, one out of five are actually paid mercenaries. And this is the American way? Chris Bowers recently documented polls showing that Americans in huge numbers, want out of Iraq. The vast majority of Americans, get us out. But the politicians in Washington, D.C., and this is the thing that boggles my mind, the Democrats among the politicians in D.C., are saying, many of them, most of them, are saying, no, we don't need a timetable. We don't have to organize getting out. This is why we stayed in Vietnam so long. It's because nobody stood up and said, hey, you know, it's not working. It's a dumb plan. We shouldn't have gone in the first place. Nobody wanted to be the person who said, oops. Because oops is fatal in politics. It's like the old joke, you know, what's the last word you want to hear the dentist say when he's working on you? Oops. And so no politician wants to be the person who's saying, well, you know, don't believe we should have done that. And there's very few who actually can do it without looking like they've reversed policy. You got Dennis Kucinich and a couple others there who have been opposed to this war and other wars from the get-go. But they're very much in the minority. So you have this large majority of Democrats, even, who can't come out and speak out. And we have this messy situation. Making up this from the Christian Science Monitor, Patrick Johnson wrote this, making up 7% of America's active fighting force, immigrants with green cards, Mexicans, the largest group among them, are risking their lives not just for advancement within the Army, but for a leg up on the road to U.S. citizenship. As America celebrated its 229th year of independence this weekend, immigrants offered their own breed of patriotic sacrifice, and their numbers are rising even as the Army has struggled to meet recruiting goals. They quote Sergeant Escartin, who's based in Fort Bliss, Texas. He says, if I die over there, I'm not even dying for my own country. He's Mexican, a citizen of Mexico. You know, in the Declaration of Independence, one of the claims, one of the complaints that we had about England was that England was using foreign mercenaries against us. And then, you know, as Charles Pena, a defense policy analyst at the Libertarian Cato Institute, says, there are many stories about young men and women who signed up knowing that they would eventually gain citizenship but were subsequently killed. The question is, was their ultimate sacrifice worthwhile? Some generals, writes Patrick Johnson in the Christian Science Monitor, some generals say that increasing the foreign presence in American ranks could dilute the troops' sense of unity and common purpose. Is there something we need to worry about here? Over 7,000 foreign-born military grunts are naturalized every year, processed through a special immigration office in Nebraska, in one-fourth the time required for a regular application. You want to get U.S. citizenship? Normally it takes, what, 5, 6, 7 years? You can do it in less than 2? Join the Army. Go to Iraq, and if you survive, we'll make you a citizen. And if you die, we'll make you a citizen posthumously. I have said before that we didn't end slavery in the United States. Everybody says, oh, we ended slavery with the Civil War, the end of the Civil War. Well, it's back. It's back in a big way. The computer that I'm looking at right now is made in China by slaves. Probably most of the clothing I'm wearing was made in various parts of the world where slave labor is employed, since we don't make clothes in the United States any longer. It's, you know, as I look around me, I'm probably 4/5 of the stuff that's around me was made by slaves. We didn't end slavery in the United States. We merely exported it. And unlike the founders of this country, we don't have to look our slaves in the face and deal with the moral dilemma that it presents. We just go down to Walmart and buy our slave goods, our slave-made stuff. And not just Walmart. Try and find a shirt made in the United States. Try and find a pair of shoes made in the United States. Good luck. Even Levi Strauss closed their last American factory last year. Try and find a pair of blue jeans made in the United States. So, you know, we didn't end slavery, we just exported it. Well, as Johnson points out in this Christian Science Monitor article, he says, with thousands of immigrants in Iraq and elsewhere, the U.S., critics say, is outsourcing its war. So we've exported our... We have our slaves again, and now we have our mercenaries again. Is this the kind of country that the United States has always thought of itself as? I don't think so. You know, for me, it just seems wrong. ZNet, Andy Clarno and Salim Valley wrote a piece for ZNet, zmagazine.org. Startling fact has emerged from the battlefields of Iraq, providing powerful evidence that the conduct of war has been radically transformed over the last 15 years. In the 1991 Gulf War, one in every 100 soldiers deployed by U.S.-led coalition were mercenaries hired by private military companies. Today in Iraq, more than one in five coalition soldiers are mercenaries. Since the mid-1990s, the private military sector has been the fastest-growing industry in the world. With the U.S. as its biggest client, the industry was worth $100 to $200 billion per year before the invasion of Iraq. There are currently 130,000 U.S. soldiers, 9,000 British soldiers, 15,000 combined all the other coalition soldiers in Iraq. However, 30,000 U.S. mercenaries, the second largest military force in the country. War profiteers like Bechtel and Halliburton, say Clarno and Valley, hire private armies to protect their assets, paying mercenaries up to $1,000 a day for special assignments quelling uprisings in Iraqi cities. And are the Iraqis happy about this, about having mercenaries in their country? I suspect not. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our chat room. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom. It's a beautiful sunny day here in San Diego. I got a message from a friend of mine who was a senior contracts administrator with a government contracting company. He sent me a link to a newspaper that's actually in Spanish but can be translated. It's about our soldiers in Iraq, and you had just covered that. This is really concerning because those people are so poor. They are doing exactly what Jefferson warned against, is hiring soldiers paid guns.
Yeah, Jefferson said, I hope we will never, I'm paraphrasing now, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but this is pretty close. I hope we shall never become a country that is willing to allow its children to be shot at for a sixpence.
It's a little bit more than the sixpence they're getting.
Yeah. Well, sixpence was actually pretty good money back then, but yeah.
But it beats the local market.
Yeah.
There, not only are we exporting soldiers, we're outsourcing, we're destroying markets in the Honduras. We're destroying markets in El Salvador.
You're talking about by importing our cheap corn?
No, well, we're taking away their workers. We're taking away their
young men. Oh, I see. Their people are coming to the United States to join our military.
Right. We're destroying their markets down there.
Well, I, Scott, yes and no. The reality is that we're doing that with illegal immigration. Our corporations in the United States who hire illegal immigrants are certainly doing that. But in order to get into the U.S. Army, you have to have a green card. You have to have gone through the whole song and dance. So I don't think that we're depopulating South and Central America in order to fill the ranks of our army. I think you can make that argument about illegal immigrants who are working in the United States.
I was in Kanab, Utah recently, and I was approached by the restaurant owner because I also speak Spanish, and we were talking, and she said that she had a tremendous problem finding help in Kanab. She said none of the young people want to work. None of the hotels, none of the tourists, shops, nobody can get help in town. We're desperate for help.
And the reason for that is?
Well, they don't have any labor. There's no immigrant labor there at all. They have no immigrant labor to speak of. I couldn't find anybody like I do here that's working in the working as a dishwasher Hispanic or working yard work because it doesn't exist there. It's Hispanic.
This was in Honduras, you said?
No, this is what I'm talking about, Kanab, and getting help and getting labor.
Oh, in what country are you talking about?
Oh, this is the United States.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're talking about getting help and getting labor, and they cannot find help. She's paying $8.25 an hour for busboys,
yeah,
plus tips. She can't find help.
Well, let me reframe that, Scott. What she can't find is help that's willing to work for $8.25
an
hour.
$8.25 an hour in Kanab, that's right.
Right.
She cannot find it, and she says she can't make any more money than that on her restaurant.
Well, that's arguable. Since the cost of a busboy is a very small part of the cost of a meal, my guess is that if her prices went up 1% or 2% and she started paying her busboys $10 an hour, she'd be okay.
Probably have a point, Tom. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. It's good to hear from you. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Interesting stuff in the news today. Bill targets a dividend loophole for firms based in tax havens. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Actually, before I get to that, I want to just wrap up this thing about what's going on in Iraq. First of all, I think it's interesting. One of the folks in our chat room posted a link to an indie media site. These are all over. There's this huge, pervasive across America belief that the Bush administration is lying to us about the number of people who've actually died in Iraq. And the theory is that if somebody dies on the way to the hospital in Germany, or in Germany, or on the way back home from the battlefield in Iraq, or, you know, basically not on the battlefield, that they're not counted, and that the actual number of war dead may be as high as 8,000 or 9,000, and there's an attempt to count them. They're putting out a call. Please, you know, if your son, daughter, husband, wife, whatever, is not on the official list of war casualties in Iraq, please let us know. And I think this is interesting. Frankly, the fact that it hasn't come out before now, that's going on, that there hasn't been a Christian Breitweiser, that there hasn't been a spokesperson, that somebody hasn't come out and said, yes, my husband or yes, my son or whatever was, you know, died in the hospital in Germany as a result of injuries in Iraq and was not listed as a war casualty. The fact that nobody has come out as that person to do the you know, to be available to talk programs like this or to be on Democracy Now!, that causes me to think that perhaps the Department of Defense actually has been listing those persons who die in transit and die in the hospital as Iraq casualties. And in fact, I've seen recently some of the casualty listings of, you know, this is so-and-so who died, you know, in Germany. But, you know, we'll see. We'll find out. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, what's happening in the belly of the beast there?
Well, the belly of the beast itself is fairly quiet. The action's really taking place outside the Beltway, both in terms of speculation as to whether two journalists are going to be jailed for not revealing their sources, and also in terms of the G8 summit, President Bush's remarks about how all the different sides on the Supreme Court nominee issue need to turn down the rhetoric, and continued speculation in Washington as to who the next nominee is going to be.
So Bush has already spoken at the G8. What's happening there?
He hasn't spoken yet. No, they're all still arriving. He spoke in Denmark during a press availability. That's when he spoke about the Supreme Court nominees. At the G8, they're basically, I suppose, unpacking their suitcases and settling in.
So the official conference begins tomorrow?
Correct, yes.
I see.
There's
I see.
A dinner. And, you know, then he'll get a chance to sample what the French are describing as atrocious food.
You don't like that characterization of British food, do you?
No, I'm ticked off with it because so much work went in over, like, the last 30 years to really make it incredibly good, and it is.
Yeah.
But it takes another 30 years for the press to catch up with it. And so, I'm just generally...
Well, Jacques Chirac, he was just being a French snob, and he might have even been speaking facetiously. I mean, who knows?
Well,
although I doubt it.
Exactly. You see, it might have been facetious, but there's always a little stab in the back, you know, in the side or the back or wherever he likes to stab people.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the big questions, as I'm sure you and your audience already know, is whether anything really can come out of this other than some nice words, maybe some talk about doing anything, but whether anything...
Well, there is some speculation that Bush is going to give on global climate change, that he's going to suggest that although he won't sign Kyoto, that there should be some sort of signing of, you know, agreements to trap carbon and go to enhanced technologies, and that he'll probably try and figure out a way to do it as tax cuts for oil companies, but that he'll do something.
Yes, I think he needs, and I think he knows he needs to give something on this, which is why we've seen very vague mentions of how, you know, human beings may play a very slight role in this, not quite his words, but pretty much.
Right.
Yes, I think he may give something, but not anything that's going to impact, as you said, the major parts of the economy.
It'll be largely cosmetic in all probability. But it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Victoria Jones, thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. I'm Tom Harbin. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back.
Show me the country where the bombs had to fall. Show me the ruins.
And welcome back. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman with you. It's getting semi-official. I mentioned here on this program last week that it could be that the government of Great Britain is going to pull its troops out of Iraq, or pull a good chunk of them out of Iraq, in part perhaps because Tony Blair is not all that happy with George Bush slapping him in the face over global warming and African aid. Although Bush has been doing a lot for Africa, apparently. But global warming, no. And this has been Blair's signature issue. And so is Bush going to give him something, or is he going to turn around and say, okay, here's back at you, George, and pull some of the British troops out of Iraq? Well, now this comes out in today's paper. Yesterday's paper, actually. Yesterday afternoon's paper. Let's see, what is this? This is additional reporting by Victor Burnett in Kabul. I don't have the paper that it was from. I believe this is from The Independent. Anyhow, it's one of the British papers. The Ministry of Defense has drafted plans for a significant withdrawal. This is by Jimmy Burns and Peter Spiegel. For a significant withdrawal of British troops from Iraq over the next 18 months... and a big deployment to Afghanistan, the Financial Times has learned. Ah, this is from the Financial Times. In what would represent the biggest operational shakeup involving the armed forces since the Iraq War, the first stage of a rundown in military operations is likely to take place this autumn. Now, this autumn is like the month after next, with a handover of security to Iraqis in the at least two southern provinces. This is interesting. So they're going to pull out a whole bunch of troops and then increase the number of troops going to Afghanistan, which makes a certain amount of sense. After all, Osama bin Laden was and may still be in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is nowhere near secured. I mean, we're now fighting the Taliban in the south and the east. We're fighting the opium farmers and the warlords in the north. We're fighting the jihadists and the folks coming over from Pakistan, the Wahhabists, the bin Laden bunch in the extreme east. Hamid Karzai, the former Unocal oil company executive or consultant, Hamid Karzai, who claims to be the president of the country, is referred to in Afghanistan as the mayor of Kabul, and he doesn't even control the entire city of Kabul. So the Brits are saying, well, you know, why are we in Iraq? I don't recall that, you know, Iraq had anything to do with 9/11. Do you? No, I don't either. Well, so what are we going to do? Well, maybe we should go to Afghanistan. Sounds like a good plan. Right? Doesn't it make sense? Keep in mind, it wasn't Tony Blair's decision to go to Iraq. And it certainly wasn't Osama bin Laden's decision, right? Now, I would say wrong on that, by the way. I would suggest to you that Osama bin Laden was hoping and praying that we would attack Iraq. Because it was the very best thing that could have been done for him. We handed him such a recruiting poster when we invaded Iraq. It was just exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted. And, of course, George W. Bush...
Osama bin Laden doesn't get to decide... The American people decide. I decided the right action was in Iraq.
Yes. Where is Mr. bin Laden, Mr. Bush? These are just so great. I have to play them over and over. Where is Mr. bin Laden, Mr. Bush?
So I don't know where he is. Nor do, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him. I'll be honest with you.
You just don't spend that much time with him. It's no. All I have to say to that...
You're despicable.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, so enough about that. Anyhow, the point is that it looks like the British are getting ready to move out of Iraq. And that's going to leave us, what, standing going, what? Hello? Anybody here? What happened? As Mr. Reed of the UK, this one of the sources who spoke to the Financial Times said, so although Donald Rumsfeld may have said correctly that this may take years before it's finally completed, that did not imply that all that period will have to be led by the multinational forces or the British forces. Mm-hmm. So get ready. In fact, the article in the Financial Times, by next April, a best-case scenario would see current troop levels of 8,500 reduced to about 4,000 to 5,000, with a further cut in the period leading to the first quarter of 2004, when the British military presence is expected to fall to about 1,000 advisors and training personnel. So they're saying basically within, what, 6 months, the Brits are out. They'll have a few advisors and training personnel left over, and maybe they'll be mercenaries. Maybe they'll find some, you know, Halliburton-type corporation that for $100,000 a day wants to hire people and send them in. Time will tell. Sounds reasonable. The Wall Street Journal, a couple of interesting pieces from the Wall Street Journal today that are really worthy of note. The first is, this is, you know, I predicted this. I'm telling you, I predicted it. You want to see the prediction? Go to commondreams.org and look at the article that I posted yesterday. I wrote that article on Friday. And I was talking about it on this program last Thursday and Friday. I wrote the article on Friday and Saturday. It went up on Common Dreams. I submitted it to them Monday. It went up on Tuesday. And it's about how the media is ignoring the fascist card that the Bush administration is probably planning on playing with regard to the Supreme Court. Because if you look at the candidates for the Supreme Court that are out there, the ones that are being hailed, here are the candidates, right? And here's all these folks. And you look at their CVs, you look at their histories. What you get is that of the big 10 names that are being floated, and I would make that 11, I would add Janice Rogers Brown to it. Of the big 10 names, 7 of them are solid anti-abortion folks. That's why they're there. Now, the business community is very worried about these folks because the anti-abortion folks tend to be states' rights folks as well. They tend, in fact, to say that the whole reason why the federal government shouldn't be in the fight at all about abortion is because it should be left up to the states. And, you know, and that's their rationale. It's a states' rights argument. Now, the business community is not comfortable with that. The Wall Street Journal yesterday talking about how Sandra Day O'Connor was a friend to business. And the reason the business community is not comfortable with that is because the business community does not like states' rights. They want to be able to buy and sell their politicians federally. One-stop shop in Washington, D.C. Set up an office in K Street, put a few lobbyists in, toss a few million bucks a year there, and you can buy all the legislation you need, all the regulation. You can buy your own USDA regulations, your own FDA regulations, your own Department of whatever it is, your own Homeland Security contracts. All you need is one-stop shopping right there in Washington, D.C. You don't want people to be able to sue you? Fine. You can do it all right there. And so the business community would rather not have an anti-abortion states' rights person. They're a little nervous about, for example, Scalia and Thomas. Because Scalia and Thomas keep ruling and saying, you know, if people in a state want to sue, that's up to the state. They want to sue a business. And that makes it very expensive. Businesses have to go around on a state-by-state basis and come up with laws to prevent lawsuits, for example. So you've got 7 folks who are there because of their anti-abortion credentials. You have 2 folks, or arguably 3, who are there because they are friends of business. They are lawyers who used to be corporate lawyers working to protect corporations against lawsuits from people who had been harmed. And then you have one person who doesn't fit into either of those 2 categories. Alberto Gonzalez. And the press is putting him into a third category called, you know, FOB, Friends of Bush. And I would say that, it goes a little beyond that. That Alberto Gonzalez's agenda is the same as the George W. Bush agenda, and that is turning America into a fear-based, single-party state where the rights of individuals are no longer respected, the Constitution is no longer respected, the rule of law is no longer respected. The only thing that's respected is raw power, exercised by the party, the Republican Party, controlled by the neocons. And the Republican Party will get its tentacles into the churches and corrupt them, and it's doing it aggressively. And it will get its tentacles into social organizations and corrupt them, and it's doing it aggressively. It'll get its tentacles into the military and corrupt that, and it's doing it aggressively. And they will politicize our intelligence apparatus, which they are doing aggressively, our domestic police services. Today, the Army announced that they have plans, that they have drafted plans. I mean, they didn't so much announce it as they admitted it, that they have plans to use the military within the borders of the United States. Now, this is a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, a law that was passed back after the Civil War that said that you can't have military services used against American civilians. The military may only be used against foreigners. The reason why? Well, you don't ever want a military coup. You don't want the military messing in domestic affairs. That's the purpose of police, who are controlled by local communities. So as the power of the gun, the legal power of the gun, the legal power of the jail cell, should always be held close to the local community so that local communities can restrain it, because it's a fearsome power. And here in the Washington Post today, this article by Bradley Graham, a new Pentagon strategy for securing the U.S. homeland calls for expanded U.S. military activity, not only in the air and sea, where the armed forces have historically guarded approaches to the country, but also on the ground and in other less traditional, potentially more problematic areas, such as intelligence sharing with civilian law enforcement. The strategy is outlined in a 40-page document approved last month. Last month. It raises the likelihood that U.S. combat troops will take action in the event that civilian and National Guard forces are overwhelmed. Why might they be overwhelmed? Well, could be because they're all in Iraq. Some provisions of the appear likely to draw concern, notes the Washington Post, from civil liberties groups that have warned against a growing military involvement in homeland missions and an erosion of long-established barriers to military surveillance and combat operations in the United States. The document acknowledges, for instance, plans to team military intelligence analysts with civilian law enforcement. It asserts the president's authority to deploy ground combat forces on U.S. territory. This is today's Washington Post. The document, titled Strategy for Homeland Defense and Civil Support, was signed June 24th by Acting Deputy Defense Secretary Gordon England and is now a basis for organizing troops. This is a done deal. Developing weapons and assigning missions. It was released late last week without the sort of formal news conference or background briefing that often accompanies major defense policy statements. The Washington Post notes, legal barriers to sending the armed forces into U.S. streets have existed for more than a century under the Posse Comitatus Act, enacted in 1878. The law was prompted by the perceived misuse of federal troops after the Civil War to supervise elections in the former Confederate states. Over the years, the law has come to reflect a more general reluctance to involve the military in domestic law enforcement. People are not comfortable with this. Gene Haley, a senior editor at the Cato Institute. This is a libertarian very conservative. This is more conservative than conservative. Policy Research Group in Washington, D.C., quote, "The move toward a domestic intelligence capability by the military is troubling. The last time the military got heavily involved in domestic surveillance during the Vietnam War era, military intelligence kept thousands of files on Americans guilty of nothing more than opposing the war. I don't think we want to go down that road again." Mr. Healy, I think we are already going down that road. And that's where, you know, that brings us to, as it were, my original, you know, where I started with all this, and that is today's Wall Street Journal saying, and this is what I told you would happen, that the conservatives are going to attack Gonzalez, and Bush is going to come out and say, see, he's a centrist. Behind the scenes, this is from today's Wall Street Journal, behind the scenes, a senior administration official said criticism from conservatives would not pose a significant obstacle to Gonzalez's prospects for nomination, and the opposition to the right actually might help the attorney general's chances of winning confirmation because it would make him appear more acceptable to those in the middle of the political spectrum, particularly the seven Democrats who cut a deal with seven Republican senators, promising not to support a filibuster of judicial nominees except in extraordinary circumstances. There you go. Right there. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Got to go back.
Back to democracy. Yes, welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. The latest Gallup poll released today finds that not only is there increasing public frustration with the war in Iraq, but the public is not too confident that the United States and its allies are winning the war against terrorism. Well, we're not winning the war against drugs. We're not winning the war against poverty. Why should we win the war against terrorism? All wars against euphemisms generally are doomed. Euphemisms don't fall over quite so easily. About a third of Americans think the United States is winning the war on terror. 20% say the terrorists are winning. 41% say neither side is winning. Second consecutive survey in which 20% of respondents say the terrorists are winning. The number saying the U.S. is winning, 36%, is the lowest mark in 2 years. Interesting. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Paul in Beltsville, Maryland on the line. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Something that you were talking about, you know, the military gaining more power and the whole thing about Iraq, and I've come up with an idea, and I haven't heard it proposed anywhere else, I don't think. Maybe it has been, but to try and force the issue of our involvement in Iraq and the whole back chatter about a draft, has anybody suggested a campaign to starve the beast by trying to discourage anybody who's considering joining the military of doing so?
Well, no, not to the best of my knowledge. I mean, there are campaigns. The Quakers, for example. You know, I mean, some religions have a long history of working with people to discourage militarism and help kids who are in get out. I'd say that you know, to the best of my knowledge, though, there's not an active campaign to do that. And I think that if somebody were to launch such a campaign, it probably wouldn't work, because the reason why people are joining the military now have not much to do with the kinds of reasons that you can discourage somebody from by an advertising campaign. They have to do with desperation. People are joining the military because they think they're going to get their military, their student loans paid off. They're joining the military because they're in poverty, and they see no other way out. I mean, they occasionally you get the Pat Tillman type, you know, somebody who joins because they think it's their patriotic service. I think, you know, and you've got, you know, 7% of the military joined because they want to become citizens. So,
yeah.
I don't think a campaign is going to stop those folks.
Okay. By the way, I don't think any of the other progressive talk show hosts have picked up on this fascist play angle on the Supreme Court. I've been listening around, and you're the only one saying anything about that.
Well, there you go. We're usually out in the front of things, but sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. Thanks a lot, Paul. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Yes, this is the real free speech zone. No barbed wire. No passes from the RNC. We won't drag you off if you've got a no blood for oil bumper sticker. Heck, I won't drag you off if you've got a Bush-Cheney bumper sticker. All are welcome. I'm John Harbin.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 7 minutes past the hour. We'll be in 4 seconds. And welcome back. Oh, my goodness, my goodness, my goodness. TomCruiseIsNuts.com. One of the folks in the chat room posted this link. It's a real website, TomCruiseIsNuts.com. And so somebody actually put a lot of work into this thing. It's a very, very well done, very strange website. I commend it to you. Anyhow, our telephone number, 1-866, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. Our chat room, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop in and participate in conversation with some of the finest minds in the entire Internet. What is this, Imbalio? I kill squirrels, I kill possums, I kill ducks, I kill mice, I kill deer. Huh? Well, some of the finest minds in the entire Internet. Yeah. It's... Yeah. Anyhow, there's a fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal today, a tax report by Rob Wells, about a dividend loophole coming up in the tax code. I want to share that with you. I'd like to get into health care. Why is it that the health care companies are telling, or the fast food companies are telling us that it's patriotic to get obese? And what's the cost to America in that? And the news of the day, Alberto Gonzalez, the fascist report, and that sort of thing. First, Brian in New Jersey's on the line. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, just something that you said in the last hour at the very end about those percentages of people who thought we were winning the war or thought the terrorists were winning. And I thought of something. I guess it depends on where you're from, because some people would even consider America the terrorist right now for going over into Iraq. And so the people that think that America's winning, that could just be added into the percentage of the terrorists winning. So...
I guess it depends on who you're asking.
Exactly.
Whether it's the average Iraqi who feels terrorized by us or terrorized by others there as a consequence of our being there.
Exactly.
Who would really rather just, you know, have their lives back.
That's all I was trying to bring up.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Good one, Brian. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Okay. Here's this piece in the Wall Street Journal. A new plan in Congress would strip the dividend tax cut from shareholders of Tyco International, Cooper Industries, Ingersoll Rand, and other companies in so-called tax haven countries. Now, this is no small thing. You will remember, way back when, and this is part of the kind of multi-level, multi-layered rationalization that these guys have been using, you'll remember way back when the Bushies were saying, taxing corporations... And then taxing dividends is double taxation. And because the corporation makes the money, and you own stock in the corporation makes the money, the corporation pays an income tax on the profit that it made, and then what's left over after the income tax, they distribute to their stockholders as dividends, and that dividend distribution is then taxed as income for those people who earn their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. And so why should those people, in theory, have to pay taxes twice? Well, first of all, it's a specious argument. A corporation is a separate entity. It's like, you know, if you are earning a salary from a corporation, that corporation has, if they show a profit, they have to pay tax. That corporation's paying taxes. Now, you can argue, okay, the salary part that the corporation is paying you is a tax-deductible expense to the corporation. You know, there are some who suggest that that shouldn't even be the case, but we put that in the tax code because we want to encourage corporations to hire people. You know, the tax code is full of loopholes for corporations because there are things we want them to do. We want them to be able to pay for lunches, business lunches. Why? Because the restaurant industry wants it. We want them to be able to hire people. It's not about double taxation or anything. It's about incentivizing specific behaviors. And there are other behaviors we don't want them to do. For example, after the first $1 million of salary, a corporation can't deduct from its income taxes additional salary. So if a CEO is making $2 million, that second million, they're having to pay income tax on that money before they pay it to that CEO. But the corporation is a separate entity. And regardless of how much money the corporation pays in taxes, you still get your paycheck and you still pay taxes on it. So why should we say, but if you earn your living not by going into work at the corporation, but instead sitting on your butt by the pool waiting for the dividend check from the corporation to come, then you should pay a different tax rate. You should pay a maximum tax rate of 15%. That's the logic that the cons used to sell this thing. And they were successful. They got it through Congress. Now, you know, part of the reason may be that a lot of members of Congress earn some of their income sitting around their congressional seat waiting for the dividend check to arrive. There's a lot of millionaires in the Senate in particular, and no small number of them in the United States House of Representatives. Could be that. Could be that the millionaires and billionaires who want to keep on getting their dividend checks were able to pass out enough money in Washington, D.C. to cause the Congress, members of Congress and the Senate to see the light. But in any case, that was the rationale that was used. So here's the, you know, this is the live by the sword, die by the sword. If the rationale that is used is that the corporation is paying income taxes, and therefore the person who gets the dividend from the corporation shouldn't have to pay income taxes, then what do you do when you have a corporation that has set up its headquarters outside the United States, at least its legal headquarters, in a post office box in the Bahamas or the Cayman Islands, for example, so that explicitly and specifically for the single purpose, so that they no longer have to pay U.S. income taxes. They pay zero. Like Tyco Industries, or Ingersoll Rand, or Halliburton's Kellogg Brown and Root division that has these billions of dollars of contracts in Iraq with guaranteed profits. Should this division of Halliburton, which has set itself up as an offshore corporation so it doesn't have to pay U.S. taxes, it's the most profitable division of Halliburton right now, should somebody who gets dividend checks from them, like Dick Cheney, for example, should they only have to pay 15% income tax on the theory that Halliburton already paid income tax on the money when, in fact, Halliburton didn't pay income tax on the money, or KBR? This is the logic that Max Baucus of Montana, the top Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, is using. He's pushing a piece of legislation that he says is going to shut a loophole in the 2003 law that Congress passed, the third of the Bush tax cuts. It's going to close a loophole so that companies that move offshore, when they pay their dividends, you have to pay the full load. If you're 35% income tax bracket, you pay 35%, just like somebody who works for a living in the 35% bracket. Oh, horrors! Who could imagine? Now, you've got Senate Finance Chairman Charles Grassley, the Republican from Iowa. He's, according to this article in the Wall Street Journal, is a Rob Wells column, Tax Report, he's actually on record as saying that he doesn't think that people who are getting dividends from corporations that have incorporated offshore to not pay taxes should have to pay tax, should get this tax break. In other words, they should pay. Now, if you're getting your money from Tyco or from Halliburton, you should pay the same tax rate as anybody working, if the way that you earn your living is sitting around waiting for the dividend check to show up. But he hasn't signed on to the bill. Nor have any other Republicans, reports Rob Wells. Not one. Tyco freaking out. They issued a warning about substantial adverse tax consequences to their shareholders to move their headquarters back to the U.S. The company, this from Rob Wells, the company estimated the tax hit for some of its shareholders would be as much as $1.60 a share based on 2003 figures. Boy, they must be paying huge dividends. 93% of the shareholders voted to stay in Bermuda. They don't believe, they're going to call the bluff of Congress. They don't believe that Congress is going to do it. They figure, yeah, we got enough lobbyists, we got enough money, we'll blow them away. Meanwhile, Bush has a tax reform panel. Senator Connie Mack, the Republican of Florida, is in charge of this thing. And they're sitting down, a nine-member panel, they're sitting down, they have been for several weeks now, in Washington, D.C., to write a new tax code for the United States. The only problem, as Republicans are wont to do, think of Dick Cheney and his oil industry friends, Dick Cheney and the energy policy for the United States, they are meeting in secret. In secret. Not in private. In secret. That's a quote from the Wall Street Journal. Bush's tax reform panel is deliberating in secret. After nine public hearings, they're sitting down quietly and putting this stuff together. Despite protests, notes Rob Wells in the Wall Street Journal, despite protests from some news media groups, public interest groups cite potential conflicts of interest. Since Mr. Mack, now here's where it gets really weird. Okay, former Senator Connie Mack, he's no longer the senator from Florida. He's a former senator from Florida. He's the one who is the chairman of the panel that's rewriting our tax code. He also has another job. Yeah, Connie Mack, he's got another job, and actually a full-time job for which he's paid very well. He's a lobbyist at the law firm of King & Spalding. Larry Noble, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, says the outcome of this would be of interest to his clients. Yeah, I would think so. The guy's a lobbyist for one of the biggest lobby firms in the United States, King & Spalding. Mr. Mack says, however, that he isn't lobbying on tax issues. No, he's simply writing the taxes. There's nobody for him to lobby. What, is he going to lobby himself? He's going to walk up to a mirror and he's going to say, you know, Connie, I think that we ought to give more tax breaks to billionaires and some tax breaks to millionaires. How about that? And then he'll look at himself in the mirror and say, you know, I'm not sure that's such a good idea. I think that we should give more tax breaks to millionaires and smaller tax breaks to billionaires. And then he'll look himself in the mirror again and say, well, no, let's go with the billionaires as first priority, millionaires as second. And he'll have this argument with himself and lobby himself. No, that's not what's happening. And he's, you know, Mr. Mack says he isn't lobbying on tax issues. Who's he going to lobby? He's the chairman of the panel. No, he's just writing the law. Welcome to Bush World, my friends. Ain't it amazing? It's just incredible. By the way, if you want to make your thoughts known about this, you can call your elected member of the Senate, would be in this case, at 1-877-SOB-USOB. It's a toll-free number for the United States Senate. It's Tom Hartman, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
In this world, there's a whole lot of trouble, baby. In this world, there's a whole lot of pain. In this world, there's a whole lot of trouble, but a whole lot of ground to gain. Why take when you could be giving? Why watch as the world goes by? It's a hard enough life to be living. Why walk when you can fly?
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Today is George Bush's 59th birthday. Note the folks over at thinkprogress.org. They've put together a list of birthday wishes for Bush. Bush, of course, these are all quotes from George W. Bush saying what he wishes he had. And says it's interesting, slightly instructive. Bush says, I wish I could simply wave a magic wand and lower gas prices tomorrow. Well, actually, you know, if you'd picked up on Jimmy Carter's energy policy, maybe you could have reduced gas consumption to the point that oil prices wouldn't be going through the roof and they never would have gone up. He says, I wish I had more free time. I had more time for a workout. More free time for a workout. Well, you know, we'll arrange for that in 2008. Or if the House and Senate flip in 2006 to the Democrats, we'll arrange for it right after your impeachment. He says, Bush, this was on April 13th of 04, he says, I wish you'd given me this written question ahead of time so I could plan for it. We'll give you written questions ahead of time when you're no longer president. Come on. He says, yeah, on July 30th of 04 last year, he says, gosh, I wish we were fishing. He says, I'd like to remind people, this is in 03, he says, I'd like to remind people, I wish government could make people love one another. I would sign that piece of legislation. Yes, that's very Bushian, isn't it? Let's force people with the power of a rifle, the power of the police, let's force people to love each other. How about a war with a timetable? Yeah, he wishes he had that. On April 29th of 2002, he says, I wish I could tell you that, what the timetable is going to be. He really wishes that. How about a war without troops? He says, I wish I never had to commit troops. How about a war without a president? George W. Bush, I wish I wasn't the war president. Who the heck wants to be a war president? I don't. Yeah. Somehow it just doesn't quite make it for me, George. It just doesn't quite make it. Doesn't do it. The military, we were speaking of the military a little earlier, and I wanted to get into this issue of obesity in the United States and the consequences of it. I'm convinced, by the way, and I've said this before, I'll say it again, that the obesity epidemic in the United States started exploding in 1980. I'm convinced it has to do with corn syrup. Now, I know that there are a lot of folks who think that it's really the confluence of a whole bunch of things. It's perhaps that. It's perhaps we have a more sedentary lifestyle. It's perhaps people watch more TV. They drive instead of walking. All those things. You combine all those things, and you've got the reason why. Could be. It seems to me, though, pretty clear. You go back and you look at when the soft drink industry, when Coke reformulated its product and whatnot, you look at when the soft drink industry started replacing regular cane sugar with corn syrup and then started aggressively marketing into our schools, we saw this explosion of obesity begin. And corn syrup is metabolized, and not just obesity, but type 2 diabetes as well. Corn syrup is metabolized in the body in a different way than any other kind of food. It's not a naturally occurring food. It's not just something that happens to be in corn. It is a chemical derived from corn. It's a brand new, high fructose corn syrup is a brand new chemical in our food supply. And people are, some people are ingesting pounds of this every week. Well, certainly many, dozens, hundreds of pounds a year. And I think it's getting them. It's getting them. Well, our military is having a problem with it. We'll get to that after the break. Your calls, our telephone number, 866-889-8894, TomHartman.com if you want to drop into the chat room, and more right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where being progressive never felt so good.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
My friend Greg says it's all good. As the eastern seaboard's blown away.
Uh-oh.
Now everything is going half price.
And welcome back, my friends. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Dave in Humboldt County, California, on the line. Hey, Dave.
Tom.
There's that echo again.
Oh, is it? Yeah. I'm. It's not at this end this time. Usually I hear the echo.
So what's up?
I'm reading the blackboxvoting.org because it's pointing out that some 25 million people voted on these trick machines the last time, and they've added a whole lot more since then. It's about a third of the electorate's going to be voting on these things. What I don't know is, are there some of our courageous members of our Senate and House, are they speaking out on this issue and the press not covering it? Or
yes.
That's what's happening.
Yes, Bernie Sanders talks about this. Rush Holt talks about this. I've got to pot you down when I'm talking, Dave. I'm sorry. But, yes, there's a number of members of Congress who are talking about these issues and talking loudly about them. And, they're, you know, Senator Hillary Clinton introduced legislation into the United States Senate to try and do something about this. And it's all being blocked by the Republicans in the House and Senate, and it's not being covered by the press.
Amazing, amazing, amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, you do speak about it, and I think we've got to get everybody that we can, because that a couple of goons can just block this and steal the whole election is just, to me, unthinkable.
Well, and it goes beyond just the voting machines that you're talking about, the black box voting machines. Now you have the any kind of voting machines, including the central tabulators, the you know your basic tabulator machines. They are as accessible as are the black box voting machines. They can be hacked as well.
I believe it. I've seen them at work.
Yeah.
And so. We're going to get stuck with this yet another time unless somehow, some way, we can get them out and made honest and verifiable. And they're not letting it happen. Something's got to. We can't go through this again. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling we're going to. Yeah.
Thank you for trying as best you can.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot, Dave. Good to hear from you. I mean, this is a real problem for the United States. It's you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Clearly the thing to do is, first of all, if you know who your elected representative is, even if you don't, you can call up and simply say, you know, here's my zip code. Please tell me who my elected representative is, even if you don't know who it is. You can call 1-877. It's toll free. 1-877-SOB-USOB. That's the telephone number. 1-877-SOB-USOB. And say, you know, please get involved with either Rush Holt's bill in the House of Representatives to ensure safe voting, guaranteed voting, or Senator Hillary Clinton's bill in the United States Senate to ensure, you know, legitimate voting. Because we just, you know, we would like to know that when we vote on one of these machines, that our vote is actually going to be counted, that it's not going to be hacked. And, you know, I'm telling you, they are getting hacked constantly. Frank Zappa, back in the mid-1980s, was predicting, you know, people say, oh, come on, how can you say that, you know, fascism is coming, you know, blah-de-blah-de-blah. You know, Alberto Gonzalez, you're just being paranoid, Tom. You know, I hear this stuff from people. And Frank Zappa was on Crossfire. I mean, Frank is no longer with us now. Frank Zappa was on Crossfire and had a very revealing exchange with the fellow that some refer to, that John Stewart, The Daily Show, refers to as a scumbag for liberty, Robert Novak. This is Frank Zappa and Robert Novak on Crossfire back in the mid-1980s.
The biggest threat to America today is not communism. It's moving America toward a fascist theocracy. And everything that's happened during the Reagan administration is steering us right down that pipe.
Oh, Mr. Zappa, do you really think? I mean, all kidding aside, in this country, with the permissiveness that we are moving toward a fascist theocracy, do you think things like this would ever have been permitted?
Give me that famous smile again.
When we were kids, you're about my age, maybe
I'm
a little
45.
Younger. Well, I'm 55. Do you think when I was a kid that they would permit songs like that to be sold? I mean, permissiveness is the game. You're not really serious if you're saying we're going toward a fascist theocracy.
That's right, we are.
Wait a minute.
In what way? Give me one example.
One example of a fascist theocracy.
And here it comes. Here now, One example of a fascist theocracy. Please, Mr. Zappa, please, one example.
When you have a government that prefers a certain moral code... Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, this was 20 years ago.
...derived from a certain religion, and that moral code turns into legislation to suit one certain religious point of view.
Mr. Zappa.
And if that code happens to be very, very right-wing, almost... Toward Attila the Hun.
Well, then you are an anarchist. Every form of civil government is based on some kind of morality, Frank.
Morality in terms of behavior, not in terms of theology.
See, and that's Frank Zappa is so brilliant because he points out the big difference. We were talking about this yesterday on the program, the difference between behavior and theology. Now, here, apropos to what Dave raised, you know, what are the levels of, what are the levers of fascism? For those of you who maybe thought, well, you know, that Hartman guy, he's just being paranoid with those voting machines. He's just being paranoid. Diebold machines, you know, there's got to be a trail, right? It's got to be possible to. And if this was real, the Democrats would know about it, wouldn't they? I mean, they'd be saying something, wouldn't they? After all, you know, they should be concerned about it. Well, who's the chairman of the Democratic Party right now? Howard Dean. Here's Howard Dean on Topic A with Tina Brown. He was actually hosting the program this week. And he's on with Bev Harris of BlackBoxVoting.org.
Bev sat me down, and in a few short seconds, I was amazed at what I could do.
All right, Bev, show me how to do this.
Well, what we have here is the central tabulator computer. Now, in a voting system, you have all these different voting machines at all the different polling places. Sometimes, as in a county like mine, there's 1,000 polling places in one county. All those machines feed into the one machine so it can add up all the votes. So, of course, if you were going to do something you shouldn't to a voting machine, would it be more convenient to do it to the 4,000 machines or to just come in here to one machine and deal with all of them at once?
And what's important to note here is those 4,000 machines might not be DRE machines, might not be the direct recording, whatever they are, whatever, you know, where the touch screen machines that don't produce a paper trail. Those 4,000 machines might actually be punch card readers, or they might be the little fill-in-the-circle readers that are feeding into the central tabulator. The central tabulator can take information from any kind of computer that's counting votes. It doesn't just take it from touch screens. In fact, most of the time, it doesn't take it from touch screens. Most of the time, it's taking it from other kind of machines that are, you know, here in the state of Oregon, we have voting by mail. Everybody thinks it's wonderful. Diebold makes some of the machines that are used to count the vote-by-mail ballots, because they're just like those things, you know, the tests you take in school. You fill in those little circles, you feed them through a scanner, and there's a computer that counts them. And then all those computers that count them in all the different counties and precincts and districts send their results electronically to the central tabulator computer. That's the one that Howard and Bev are playing with right now. They continue.
What surprises people is the central tabulator is just a PC. It's like you and I use. It uses Windows. It's just a regular computer.
So anybody who can hack into a PC can hack into the central tabulator.
The GEMS program is the program that is the central tabulator program. And I'm going to put in a password here. Okay, we're in. Now, this is the official program that the county supervisor sees.
Diebold program?
Yes, this is a Diebold central tabulation program.
Okay.
And then go to election summary report. And it's kind of wear and spin for a minute while it adds up all the votes from all the different precincts.
Now, keep in mind, what they're doing right now is they're actually using the software the way it's intended to be used. In other words, they're looking at the screen as if they were a person who was the precinct, you know, person or the county clerk. And the county clerk says, okay, you know, let's check out the election. Let's see how it's going. And they open up the GEMS software and they say, give me a report on what's going on. So here's the report that the county clerk is going to see.
And I can see here Howard Dean has 1,000 votes. And Lex Luthor has 500, so you're beating Lex Luthor, and we're...
2-1.
Yes, and Tiger Woods, unfortunately, doesn't have any votes yet.
All right.
All right, let's close this out. I was just showing you a way to go in and look at votes, which,
of course,
you can't tamper with. Go to the Start menu, and I'm going to show you something tricky.
Now, something tricky. Now, this is how you do it and leave no fingerprints. You don't use the GEMS program. You go into the operating system of Windows.
And I want you to go to My Computer and just click that. And you're going to see some, go to Local Disk C, go to GEMS, which is the name of the Diebold program. You're going to go to Local DB, which stands for Local Database. That's where they keep the votes. And by the way, this has been out on the Internet for ages now. Go to Central Tabulator Votes, which is the database we just looked at. And then go to the Sum of the Candidates, which is that table.
So, you know, what they've done is they've double-clicked on a database, and it's opened an Excel spreadsheet. They've opened the database without using the GEMS program, so the GEMS program doesn't know that the database has been opened or is being tampered with.
You see, we have 800 votes here for you and 400 for Lex Luthor. Let's just flip those. We'll make that 400, and we'll give 100 votes to Tiger. Let's just see what happened here. We'll go back into GEMS, the legitimate...
Okay, now they've closed the Excel spreadsheet. They've saved the file. They close the Excel spreadsheet back all the way out of the hard drive, and then they go back to the desktop of the computer and double-click on the GEMS program. So now they're looking at the screen the way that a county clerk would look at the screen.
Way, you're the county supervisor. You're checking on the progress of your election. And as you can see now, Howard Dean only has 500 votes. Lex Luthor has 900, and Tiger Woods has 100 votes. Mm. We just... edited an election, it took us 90 seconds.
We just edited an election, it took us 90 seconds. Live on national television. Howard Dean. Howard Dean. Please, any Republicans who are listening, tell everyone you know, all the conservatives, all the Republicans, Howard Dean knows how to hack a Diebold machine. Howard Dean is now the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. He's the chairman of the Democratic Party. The chairman of the Democratic Party not only knows how to hack a Diebold voting machine, he's actually done it on national television. Please tell all the Republicans you know and get them good and paranoid so that they will go out and say, you know, I'm not sure that these Diebold machines are such a good idea after all. You know, when you think about the consequences of these kind of things.
Consequences, long if I'm rich.
Yes. Well, that's the Diebold. I'm sorry, Republicans. I understand, but nonetheless, when you consider what might come out of that, might not be what you want. Might not be what you want. Let's get a good conspiracy theory going here. For the Republicans. Maybe Matt Drudge will pick it up. Howard Dean knows how to hack voting machines. Can't you just see it now? All the cons in the United States getting all hysterical. Somebody ought to write a piece for Newsmax. So we've got to get Ellen Ratner on this, right? She writes a regular column for them. So, anyhow, thanks, Dave, for getting me started on that, because it's a rant that I want to try and do at least once a month. I was going to say every couple of months. I think it's important to keep this at the surface of people's awareness. This is a real problem, and it's not conspiracy nuts who are concerned about it. It's United States senators. You have enough members of the United States House of Representatives, both Democrats and Republicans, who have signed Rush Holt's bill, who are co-sponsors of his bill, to pass it. And Denny Hastert and Tom DeLay will not allow it to come out of committee. They will not allow it to come to the floor for a vote. Now, why would that be? Why? What possible reason would they have? This bill is actually going to make more money for the voting machine companies. Because the bill mandates that any electronic voting machine has to generate a paper trail. Well, a lot of these machines out there don't generate paper trails. So you're going to need a new generation of voting machines. At the very least, you're going to have to buy printers and new software. It's going to increase the cost for government. It's going to mean more profits for Diebold and for ES&S and Sequoia Systems and all these other companies. So why doesn't Tom DeLay want this legislation passed? It's not going to harm the voting machine companies. Diebold, whose chairman was one of the heads of one of the Ohio committees to elect George Bush president. ES&S, which was a company that was derived from a company that was founded by a group of people who believed that the Bible should replace the United States Constitution. One of the other companies actually has several ex-CIA people on its board of directors, and another one of the voting machine companies is actually a significant interest owned by the Saudis. Now, you know, this is not the Art Bell Show. I mean, this is not conspiracy theory stuff. This is just, you know, what's so. And here you have the chairman of the Democratic National Party hacking one of these machines on national TV in a way that's absolutely untraceable. Don't you think you ought to be concerned? Mr. DeLay? Mr. Hastert? I mean, the Democrats could hack your elections. You never know. For some reason, they don't think that they have to be concerned. Maybe they know something we don't. Or maybe they're just being dumb. I mean, you know, that happens a lot in Washington, D.C. Maybe they've just gone over the edge. Married to the dark side, right? They've merged into the dark side of the force. They don't believe, yeah, everything's just fine, don't worry. Somehow I don't think so. This is a real issue. And you know, regardless of what talk show hosts will tell you, regardless of what politicians will tell you, it's a real issue. Talk to Hillary Clinton about it. She's trying to get a bill through the United States Senate. The Bill Frist won't allow it out of committee. And she's about as mainstream as you can get. You know, the great hope for the Democratic Party is concerned about this. This is not a fringe issue. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. The program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, who I think would have been very suspicious of voting machines, not some right-wing think tank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there.
And welcome back.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Jeff in Denver, Colorado, in Boulder, Colorado. Excuse me. Hey, Jeff.
Tom, several months ago we had the initiative. We were all signing petitions for the GAO to investigate the voting anomalies in Ohio. And I remember I even called them directly myself. And that's the last I remember hearing anything about that. Whatever became of that effort?
I don't know. I know that there was a report that was issued by the Justice Department last week, and I believe we talked about it in this program, in which they said that the issues that John Conyers had raised in his report, which is available in a book form, by the way, in a book called What's the Matter? What Went Wrong in Ohio? And there's a review of it that I wrote over at BuzzFlash.com. In any case, they addressed some of the issues that John Conyers raised in a way that didn't basically address any of the issues. They just said, you know, this is no big deal and that didn't happen and this isn't proof of fraud and this is circumstantial and, you know, that sort of thing. And they basically swept it under the rug. And that was the Justice Department, I'm pretty sure. As far as the GAO goes, to the best of my knowledge, there has not been any conclusion. I'm not even sure that there's been an investigation.
Well, that's too bad. It's the one branch of the one part of government that I actually do trust. The GAO has a very good track record of actually having some level of integrity.
I believe, though, that the GAO, I mean, the GAO is an arm of Congress, and the GAO, I could be wrong on this, but I believe that they have to have an order from Congress in order to do something, don't they?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And so if you have a majority of Congress unwilling to give the GAO an order, the GAO is not going to jump.
Yeah.
So there you get it. It gets back to Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert. What it gets back to is that if we want to find out what happened in Ohio, we have to take back the House or the Senate.
Yeah.
Very simple.
That's
too
bad.
Which means
I didn't hear anything, so I was wondering what happened, and
yeah.
I was afraid that what you just said is what actually happened.
Yeah, and I suspect it is. I'll check into it, Jeff, and I'll report back to you. But you know, it's grim times. I mean, this is why it is so important to get politically active, to get registered to vote, get other people registered to vote, get active, join a political party, show up for meetings, make the phone calls, write the letters to the editor of the newspaper, call into the talk shows, hold them accountable, keep their fire to the feet to the fire, and particularly elected representatives, keep them up. Even the Republicans, even those who disagree with you, they have to hear from you. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.